Okay, just say your name and then, you know, start way back.
Start talking,
yeah.
Okay, my name is Ding Mei Hua, or Mei Hua Ding,
okay.
Or Dr. Mei Ting,
right.
Which all in all is the same thing. What part of the story would you like me to start?
See, I don't know your story, so I'm thinking, I don't know, you know, I'd like to know. You could wear in Black Bear when I met you, when you came out to Colorado, with
okay.
more or less with Peter Coyote and that
okay.
crew.
Okay, well, I'm going to give a little bit of background.
Yeah, good.
All right. I was born in China, still at the end of World War II, in Chengdu, China, which was the furthest western city in China, which was part of the Burma Road, where the Flying Tigers flew over Burma to get into China.
Wow.
And what's significant there is before I was born, my father was transferred to the United States. And he was part of the Chinese National Air Force, which was led by Chiang Kai-shek and eventually got pushed over to Formosa, Taiwan. And so because of his achievements and what he was able to do, he was transferred to Washington, D.C. So I never really saw my father until I was about five. So I was born in October 19, 1944. And I guess maybe about the time I was a year and a half, too, my mother was able to move back to where her family was from, which is Hangzhou. That's the city that President Nixon went to visit in 1978. So that was a long distance in those days, so I never really saw my father until my mother had to leave China. We were forced to leave China because of the Chinese takeover by the communists. And so at that point, my mother's family in Hangzhou told my mother that she was a liability. So on very, very short notice, she had to leave China. And she wasn't going to take me because I was too young and I would have been in trouble. But since my father had never seen me, she decided to take me with her. That is another story. That's a wonderful story about how my mother left China. But I never met my father till I came to the United States in Washington, D.C. And then...
So that was the first city you were in the U.S.?
Well, no, we took a ship, which took 3 weeks to cross the Pacific. And the first city I ever saw was San Francisco.
Right.
And from San Francisco, we flew to Washington, D.C.
So that was the first city that you lived in?
Uh-huh. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you're in Washington, D.C.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Hi, Tavilla.
I'll pick some for you now.
She's taking now.
If you go into through the dining room and go through into that room on the right, there are little containers there. If you want to keep picking, you're welcome to. You're just enjoying it. Isn't the most enjoyable heavenly thing?
Come on.
how picking raspberries is part of the delights of life. And so, yeah. So I think I was basically a transplanted Chinese person to the United States, and I spent my life growing up on the East Coast, from Washington, D.C. to Hyattsville, Maryland, to Queens Village, New York City, to Newark, New Jersey. And I always wanted to be an artist, but my mother told me that being an artist, I would not make any money, and I should become a doctor. So, because I had gotten a full scholarship to Boston University, I went and studied medicine in Boston. And so I graduated in 1968. And I felt so alienated, primarily from the other medical students. And I had somehow gotten to meet this young doctor-to-be who was going to Stanford. And I met him in Washington, D.C. In 1967 at a surgical conference. At that point, I did see Martin Luther King, and he was staying at the same hotel we were staying at. But at that time, I wasn't political, and I didn't really know anything. I was still what you would call just a very, very innocent young Chinese girl who was trying to be a good girl and trying to be a good doctor, but was very, very disheartened about my relationship to what was going on in the world at that time, and my relationship to other people who are studying medicine. You dropped a glass.
It's in that little closet next to the refrigerator. What kind of glass was it, Pamela? Oh, one of those. Okay. So, where were we?
You were graduating.
Oh, yeah, and I was, yeah. And so, because of this medical student, whose name was Dieter Eckhart, who went to Stanford, I decided to go ahead and apply for my internship in San Francisco. And that, so I ended up going to San Francisco in June of 1968. I really did not choose to go to San Francisco because I wanted to be a hippie. I wanted something different, though, from the regular standard of medicine and doctors in 1968. And my internship was at Mount Zion Hospital in Divisadero. And nobody believed I was a doctor because I was 23 years old and had long, long black hair. And I remember I lost my doctor's bag on arriving in the airport in San Francisco, and the guy wouldn't believe that I was a doctor and lost my bag. And when he found my bag, he delivered it to the hospital, to Mount Zion, and he sent me a dozen red roses, which I thought was utterly romantic and beautiful. That was very nice. And then, so, you know, I looked on the bulletin board at Mount Zion Hospital,
And I was looking for a place to live, and I found this place that was on Haight Street, 1166 Haight Street, for $100 a month. Mind you, this is 1968. So I said, well, I can afford that in my salary. I think my salary at that time was $7,000 a year, right? $7,200 or something like that. And so there I was, living on Haight Street.
Okay.
Right. And I was a good little Chinese girl, and for a long, long time, I just said no. Because I thought that smoking marijuana, taking acid was very dangerous. I didn't really need that. But, you know, San Francisco in that time was really fermenting. And many of the other interns and residents were doing outrageous things like taking acid and going to surgery. That was a favorite, testing or whatever they were doing. And I remember they were, the anesthesiology assistants would have nitrous oxide parties at their homes. And my favorite, my very, very favorite professor was found dead with a needle in his arm. That was very, very tragic. That was very, very tragic that happened to him. And some people thought that was planned or something, or it was, what do you call it? Like when somebody orchestrates it. Those were strange times. And I think one of my neighbors who lived on the third floor, I lived on the second floor, he was a Britisher. His name was Albert Young, and he was a photographer. And he and I got to be friends with him and his wife, Annie, and their two little kids. And one day, I was going to a concert. I had a date with the hematologist professor I had at that school. And so he gave me a purple little pill, and I went to this concert, and I heard absolutely the most amazing, magnificent music I have ever heard in my life. I do believe who was playing, he was playing a cello, and that was Carlos, you know, that famous Casados, a famous cellist. So, again, it was just one of those amazing coincidences in my life. And it certainly was magical music. And after that, I just did realize that it was perfectly all right to enhance one's senses. And that was after I lived there about a year. I did my internship with Andrew Weil, who's now very, very famous. He and I were good friends, and we would cook meals together. He was a fabulous chef and really introduced me to good food. And then the second year I was in San Francisco, I got a roommate, her name was Jackie Wildall, and she was a dance student, and she was maybe a couple years younger than me, and we had a wonderful time. She would take me to ballet classes, and she's the one who started taking me down to the Family Dog, and to the concerts in Golden Gate Park, and that's how I ended up meeting the Black Bear family, who went up to the Red House. I believe that was in the Rim. And then we went to Olema, where Peter Coyote lived that time.
So were you part of the Diggers at all, or was that after that? I think Peter was, but here he was up in Olema.
This, I think Peter was already, had been part of the Jiggers. This
right.
is already passed.
Yeah.
And this is when the quote-unquote hippies were moving out into the countryside.
Right.
And so I think by 1970, when I started getting involved, I was initially more involved politically, in which I got involved with a group of other more radical doctors, one of whom was Larry Brilliant. And so we started a publication called The Body Politic, in which there were a lot of things that we felt was wrong with the way health care was being provided in this country, that it was basically hierarchical, patriarchal, and competitive, and capitalistic. So it was a kind of a radical publication, and it was the radicalization of me as a doctor. And so part of that process and my interest started growing in communes. I applied for a federal grant, because that's what you did in those days. I applied for a federal grant to study the health care and to the health problems of communes. And, yeah.
That's a good
And it actually got approved, although at the time of approval, there wasn't any funding. So. And at that time, I was also got involved in the Free Clinic, the Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic. And they asked me to teach a class in first aid, which I thought was a good idea, that everybody learned something about first aid. And I taught a couple of classes, and I remember one day walking down Hay Street to the Free Clinic, in which there was a lot of crowds on the street, more than usual. And there was a lot of TV cameras and radios, and there was a lot of police action. And so I went down to the Free Clinic, and they were raffling for some, you know, tickets. And the first prize was a shotgun, and the second prize was rounds of ammunition for this machine gun. I don't remember, shotgun, machine gun. It totally tripped me out. I thought this movement was about love and peace, and all of a sudden it's about guns and machine guns and all this police, and this isn't what it's all about to me. So I remember I got into my car, who I bought from the hematologist. It was a little cute Volvo, you know, one of those cute little Volvos that used to be along with the VW Bugs. It was red. And so for some reason it broke, so I could only drive in second gear. I remember I drove it in second gear all the way down to the Pacific.
I got every thistle I could find, and dirt stopped, so I got down at least that deep of the woods so I could find any first thing. And I go.
So where are we?
You were discouraged by the armaments that were being auctioned.
Oh, right. So I drove to the Pacific Ocean, and I figured that was as far as I could go, and I couldn't go any further. And I just felt like I had to find something else. And that's when I decided that I was going to go visit the communes and keep on going. So I ended up driving out to Olima. And then I met up with some folks, and then we went up to Bryceland. Bryceland's another story, and that's when I went up to Black Bear. And at that point, I liked the Black Bear family a lot, and they were organizing a caravan to to go to Libre for summer solstice. And from what I knew from Peter Coyote and Peter Berg, and J.P. Pickens, they were kind of like the leaders, and Paul Shippey. We were invited to go to Libre. And so there was a lot of getting it together. I don't think we ever made it to for summer solstice. Maybe we made it for fall equinox. And that's how I ended up on the caravan. I traveled with Paul Shippey. And that's how I came to Colorado, to the Riverton Valley.
Okay, so there was some communication with Coyote and Peter Berg and stuff about coming. They must have been invited or something.
Yeah.
Right. And so the whole crew, I mean, was there anybody left at Black Bear, or did you just...
Well, no, there was actually a very small part actually came. I think Peter Berg was actually from the city.
Right, right.
And Peter Coyote is from Lima, and I don't think the people from the Red House or most of the people from Black Bear actually came to Libre. And then I think we ended up being about 18, 20 adults, maybe 4 or 5 kids, 8 dogs, and 8 vehicles that caravaned together. And actually, we left San Francisco about the same time Steve Gaskin and his family left San Francisco to go to Tennessee. But we ended up with a very different welcome than Steve Gaskin's family got. And I think, you know, from my understanding, I never went to Tennessee, but they became a lot more of a, what people would consider a coherent commune.
Right.
But Libre had already had the experience they had in Drop City, so they were already on to the next step of what community is all about.
Yeah, and one thing about Gaskin, you know, they had such a large body of people that they sent scouts out, and these scouts came to Libre, and they said, we are not going to come through here with this caravan because it's too many people, and we'll wipe you out. And so they went through Denver or someplace, and they, all the way across country, they just sent 2 or 3 guys out or whoever to say hello and be friendly, and they kept going, and we thought, that is so hip. Because if they had all come, they would have been wiped out, you know. And whereas Black Bear wasn't thinking that, you didn't have anywhere near that kind of people, but you landed, you know, and we had to deal with that. I remember it.
What do you remember?
Well, I remember a lot of people coming and being all over the place, and some of them were together, and some of them weren't at all together and needed help. And I remember you galloping around on a horse a lot.
Yeah, but
maybe
I didn't even have a horse then.
No, so that's a little later.
That's when we came on the caravan, we had Kiwa and Samurai Bob. Now Samurai Bob was part of, it's quite amazing because these names haven't been part of my vocabulary for years. And they're slipping off my tongue. It's quite amazing, right? But basically, so those were, you know, some of the people who came: Carol Saran and Grizzle.
Grizzle, right?
Okay, and then you want to sit here with us? Sit up here. Perch up here.
Don't put that away. That's the microphone.
Yeah, I know that's the microphone. But no. Sibella, you sit up here. I want you to sit up here. Or, you know, you can lie here with us. Come on. That's why we're sitting here, because you wanted to sit in these chairs. Thank you. Right? And then, let's see, so I remember a lot of the men's name, but, and then there was, who else? He's the only one who's still in the valley. Lash.
Lash, right.
Lash. Lash LaRue.
Mm-hmm.
He was part of that caravan. So I've named about all the guys that were on that caravan. We thought we were supposed to be given this great welcoming at Libre, and as it turned out, we were turned away and sent down to Ordovice. So then we camped out in Ordovice. But in all actuality, some of those people were quite civil. I was one of the more uncivilized ones because I had been at in Garberville. I was in Humboldt County, in which we were known as the motherfuckers. I was more part of the motherfuckers than the Blackberry family. We were the ones, we were the road trash, we were the road kill, in which we took over the garage at Brighton and Garberville or someplace like that. And I remember we used the pit of the, you know, that people are working on the cars. That was where we would burn the fire, and we had, that's where we hung the pot and cooked the food. And then people had their little tents and little cars around the garage up in towards the hillside. And the hippies of Humboldt County actually came one night and burnt us out. They burnt down the garage. And so therefore we were, you know, turned out into a spin and had no place that we could park our car or our tent. So that, we were the motherfuckers. So I was one of the bad ones. I mean, everybody else had a lot more going for them than I did.
But you
and
went
that's
from being
where I knew, oh, I was there with Kiwa and Samurai Bob, and we rode around in a big moving van, which was called the Pink Cloud, we called it. And what we learned from that was that if you went to a town and you went to a gas station, they would always give you enough money to get out of town.
Please leave.
The motherfuckers, that's what we were.
Yes, really.
And that was my attitude.
So there you were in Ordovice.
Yeah, there I was in Ordovice.
And you weren't particularly welcomed at Libre by, I don't know who. It must have been Peter Rabbit.
By any of you. I mean, you were just in your, you know, ivy tower of a dome and painting, you know.
Yes.
But I was scared of you in those days. You were a serious artist.
Yeah, serious, good.
Serious artist.
And all these motherfuckers invading.
Well, no, I meant, you know, who was a motherfucker? It was Ben Ego.
Yeah.
And Chipita.
Yeah.
They were part of the motherfuckers.
Right.
They were outlaws from way back. But, you know, they've gotten quite civilized now. But in those days, they were part of that group. And Jade was a motherfucker. So I was a motherfucker. A long way for a poor little proper, prim and proper Chinese girl to go.
So do you think that was the acid, or what created, what brought you from being a straight Chinese to being this motherfucker? I mean, that's a big jump in a human lifetime.
It felt very genuine to me. Of course, you know, I didn't know where to go to the bathroom and stuff like that. And those kind of things, like where you bathe, that those issues always bothered me. And I always prided myself in being clean. I might not have much clothes on, but I believed in being clean. Part of that whole digger mentality, the motherfucker mentality, was that there was so much abundance in the United States that was going to waste, that one could just live off what was called the garbage of this country. There was so much waste. And that's virtually what we did. We went to the dumpsters behind grocery stores and picked up food that was, you know, a little bad, but you could chop around it. And we would harvest artichokes from the fields and oranges from the orchards. And we just go ahead and, you know, follow the harvesters. And there'd always be carrots and cabbages behind. And, you know, clean them up and wash them. Perfectly edible. And then in those days, I think it was probably a lot easier to get food stamps. So the women who had children would get food stamps, and that's how we would buy staples like, you know, 60 pounds of honey, 20, 30, 40 pounds of flour and oatmeal. And that's how we lived. And then we had free stores where you could get clothes. So, this is May 18, and I'm talking now about how getting to Ordovice with the caravan, and we all camped. We made a circle of our vehicles down by Williams Creek, and we lived there for about a month. Camped out. It was quite fun and beautiful, and at the end of which time, I believe Peter Berg was going back to California, and Coyote was moving to the East Coast because his father was having some health problems. And so people were going in different directions, and people, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I didn't want to go east because I hated the East Coast, and I didn't want to go back out west because as far as I was concerned, that was burnt out too, like what happened at the food clinic, and my feeling that there was no place for me to go there. And so I decided to stay on Ordovice. And for me at that time, being in the valley was somewhat like, you know, something that just happened. And, you know, it's like Paul Shippey says, well, do you want to travel with me on the caravan to Libre? I said, oh, okay, you know. So that was, it was, everything was just like fortuitous. But at Ordovice, I actually made somewhat of a real decision to go ahead and stay. Should we answer the phone just a little bit? So where are we?
Paul Shippey, Ordovice Farm.
Oh, okay, so that was the only time I made a decision in which I didn't want to go east and I didn't want to go west, and I decided to stay. And I felt at that point that any political action was really quite negative. And I felt that change wasn't going to be made on the external level, and what I wanted to do was to make the change internal. And that's when I changed my name from Mei Hua to Qing Feng, which is gentle wind. And so, and then I ended up living at Ordovice. But I was fairly homeless. I think that first winter I had met up with Paul Mushin, and somebody gave us a teepee. And he traded his MG sports car for an old Chevy 3/4-ton truck. And we got the teepee and moved up to the upper land of Ordovice and lived in the teepee up there. I didn't get along very well with Benny Gilbert. I wasn't a good squaw somehow. And then, you know, I think living in the valley, it soon became evident that people needed help. Remember, I was interested in healthcare. And so that's when And actually, I think the doctors and dentists in Walsenburg, which was the closest city, I think they were terrified of us. And also, we didn't have money, so they didn't really want to do anything. But I got involved with, first I got involved because women would come and ask me if I would help them with the births. And I guess they felt that since I was a doctor, I probably knew a little bit more than they did. And for sure, you know, I had done my internship and residency in San Francisco, so I did know a little bit more. And so I started doing home births. And I, you know, I was interestingly watching all these people get hepatitis. But, you know, I never got hepatitis. I've tested myself. I have never gotten hepatitis, even though I took care of many, many people with hepatitis. I just washed my hands. It really is that simple, I think. And so, you know, and that's when I remember I was kind of in awe of you in London those days, and Linda asked me to, and you asked me to be at Lucy's birth, and that certainly kind of, I think you need to understand that from my point of view it was an honor. And it was an honor to bear witness to Luce coming into this world. And that's how I view home births, really, is that we're just witnesses to this amazing miracle that happens through the transition of the now, where we are now, and that other place that's unknown. Mm-hmm. And I think that that there's a reverence that I hold any time I go to a birth, that it's not really a medical problem or quandary or anything like that. That's not what it's all about. Of course, after all these years of being a doctor, just I recognize there's that side of that coin. And if people want me to be present, now I'm a doula, if people want me to be at the birth, that I'm there to check into reality for people too. Overall, I think that the interference that we do in living by medical doctors and nursing and that we really take the mystery out of it, out of living and loving. I'm very, very much reminded today of how important it is. So, you know, there was no health care and they were scared of us. And then the public health department started giving me used penicillin and antibiotics, and that's when I was doing, you know, kind of this little clinic at the Gardner Community Health Center in the kitchen. And we do exams on the kitchen table. And somehow when I had left California and I was part of the Motherfuckers, I was trading away my stethoscopes and medical books for gas. Because that's what I was doing. I was letting it all go. That my doctor's bag came back to me before I left on the caravan. So I saw that as a sign that I was supposed to still use this tool that was given to me. So when I got to the valley and there was that need, that's when we started working on building the clinic in Gardner. And that became, as far as I was concerned, a real community effort to provide some kind of basic help.
So you lived in a lot of different communities.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, I lived at Ortiz, and then I did get along with Ben Eagle. And then those people came up from New Buffalo, like Jeff Briggs, you know. They really thought we were the scum of the earth, too, so they asked us to leave. They looked down on us, teepee dwellers, truck dwellers. And so at that time, I had befriended Vicki and Mary, and so they invited us to go up to Red Rocker. So actually, I believe Paul and I lived at the Red Rockers for 2.5 years. And then we left the Red Rockers and we moved to Ferrocedar Farm because we were actually more interested in self-sufficiency. So at Ferrocedar Farm, at Red Rockers we had goats and gardens. At Ferrocedar Farm we grew potatoes and winter wheat, as well as had, you know, ducks and chickens and pigs. And then we were thrown out of Ferrocedar Farm because Lynn Ganez had gotten together with Steve Rain, and they didn't want to have like a commune anymore. And there wasn't any rules at Ferrocedar Farm like you guys had either. So then we bought our own property. But that was in that process, which I imagine was about 79, that Paul had come back, and since it was only fair for Paul to be there with the kids, I left our farm on Pass Creek Road and I moved to Libre and lived at Libre for that summer. I stayed there, and that's when Peter Rabbit got busted and the helicopters came. And again, I thought it was the end of the world. And then I think, wasn't that the summer that somebody drowned?
After that,
Alex drowned. Yeah. No, before that,
she OD'd on something.
Yeah. That was it was heavy.
Yes.
Heavy times. And then I went over and I stayed at David's Sussman's home, Diane and David Sussman's home, a triple way, and I lived there till Paul left. Then I moved back to my house in Pass Creek Road. So I think, you know, I've had a taste of all the different communes. And actually, I would just say that that from going from one end to the other end, I really do feel that that to me, that quest for communal living or community living really stems from the fragmentation of what's happened to the American society, that there is such a lack of sense of community anymore, that people are really, really lost. So that's where I think that really real need comes from. And and yet, for me, you know, I think very often these days I still recognize that I am a hippie because I firmly believe in all those good wishes and good thoughts that we have. And but there's a part of me that's a tad fearful about being part of a commune per se. And although I have looked into different communal or community living situations here that I've come across around San Francisco, there's not much movement. But I still believe in all that, and that's what my farm is really all about, isn't it? It's really the same experience that I was looking for in the garden.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's curious and irony that you were kind of forced out of China because of the communists, and yet you've always been communal. You wanted to be, you know, related to the community. So that's, yeah, they should have had wits and kept you there.
I think I would have done very poorly in the Chinese communistic tradition, because there's very, very little room for individual expression,
right,
which is, you know, what the American experience is really all about. I think the Chinese experience, really, I think there's a lot of parallels all around the world. I think the Chinese experience was a lot larger and a lot more organizational and a lot more about society, while the American experience of communes is a lot more free-for-all, individualistic, freedom of expression, pursuit of happiness and health and love and all that. But I think, you know, people have to recognize the parallels between those experiences over the last 50 years. That it's not really so different, you know? So that's that.
That's that, okay.